It's Saturday, June the 20th, 2020. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Well, good afternoon, and welcome to a podcast from Moving at the Speed of Creativity. As you know, if you have been a podcast listener for just about any amount of time, my podcasts here are rather infrequent. Who knows? Those may pick up. I continue to publish weekly on the EdTech Situation Room with Jason Neifer, but please do not give up because I am not giving up. I've pod faded a bit, but I'm not completely pod fading here. And I, have had this podcast channel since 2005 and I do enjoy it. And so today I am excited to bring you a recording a little bit longer. This is over an hour that takes us back 2 weeks, to June the 5th. And this was actually a recorded, conversation between Brian Turnbaugh and I. I will include in the show notes a link to Brian on Twitter and also to this document. Brian is WeGoTwits on the Twitters, and this is now a Google document. We don't have another website for this project yet, but I have started a Google website, a Google site for my media literacy, I guess, projects and different things. My Google Home is trying to talk to me now. I don't know why that happened. Anyway, you can find that at medialiteracy.westfryer.com. Brian and I met last summer at the Summer Institute for Digital Literacy, and that will be held again this year. It was going to be in Chicago, but now it's completely online. It's virtual. And I'm going to be attending again. It's July the 19th through the 24th. And it really is a fantastic opportunity not only to learn and dive deep into digital literacy, but also media literacy. And so the name of this really session that we are going to, I think, be able to share at the Summer Institute is right now called Conspiracies and Culture Wars. I've also submitted a proposal to share this at the Mountain Moot that is coming up, again, virtual, but hosted out of Bozeman, Montana. And that is coming in July 15th, 16th, and 17th. And I'll put a link to the show notes so you can check out that entire event as well as potentially this session, which is going to morph. But what Brian and I wanted to talk about really were some of the broad outlines and strokes of this project. And I guess, well, I'll summarize it by saying this, and I probably read this in the presentation as well. I said it is, as far as overview and goals, social media and digital technologies shape public perceptions, mainstream media headlines, and culture today more than ever in Earth history. To be literate and constructive citizens of our communities, everyone connected to the web needs robust skills to filter information, identify credible sources. And I guess I should have completed that sentence because it just ends. This workshop seeks to connect the dots. So this is very much a work in progress, but Brian and I have been putting together this Google Doc. We've been in contact really mainly through Twitter, and we got some good direction in terms of thinking about maybe where this might go in terms of making it into a workshop and something that would be a little bit more interactive. But it's definitely something I've got to do more work on. And as I like to do with different projects, sometimes I like to share those kind of things out there for feedback, because all ideas get better with feedback. So if you've got feedback about this, you can reach out to me. I'm W. Fryer on Twitter. You can reach out to Brian as well. You can also use my contact form, which you can find at westfryer.com/contact. So without further ado, let's go back to June the 5th, 2020 for a conversation with Brian Turnbaugh called Conspiracies and Culture Wars. Well, hello, everyone. Today's Friday, June the 5th, 2020, and his name is T-Biz, I guess, officially today, but I'm here with my friend Brian, who we met last summer at the Summer Institute on Digital Literacy. I was a novice, just the first year. Brian was returning, And we actually were roommates in the same dorm suite of the college there in Rhode Island where we were staying. And, you know, in the succeeding weeks and months, we've been exchanging a lot of tweets, you know, back and forth. So, Brian, how would you characterize the nature of our meeting today and some of the things that we've been thinking about and talking about perhaps doing together this year and in the future?
Yeah, I think we're both just kind of concerned about, I believe it was information pollution. Was that the term that you were reading about? I think you tweeted about that over the last couple of days. And I think that as educators, you know, we can't have people walking around with bad ideas that are harmful for the productive ends of civic life. And we know that there are bad actors that are out there that are wanting to separate us from our neighbors, from our from so many different elements, and it's just not productive. And we have so many problems that we need to engage collectively with, and we just can't have this type of information in any way be compromising that. And I think one of the terms that I've I want to say it was Cory Doctorow. I think that's maybe I heard in one of his interviews talking about a topic like this, but I've heard this expression used over and over again is the balkanization of epistemology, right? So it's just like, you know, we can't be siloing out our own version of truth when we have, like, you know, real things happen. You can't, you know, think that gravity has its own version of reality, right? I mean, like, there are just certain factors that are going to need our collective bandwidth of cognition and creativity to kind of get things done. So I think that's been kind of what's underpinning, you know, both of our concerns to see what are the trends, practices that are done in the places where our students are native in, and whether or not it's obviously in social media and how those factors and forces are kind of crawling in.
Absolutely. You know, I've wanted to get together with this group that Renee Hobbs, you know, heads up for a number of years because I've seen her work, around copyright, around, you know, media remixing, and media literacy. And boy, last summer, I really felt like I connected with my tribe. And I really have a sense that media literacy and working in media literacy is not only something that I want to do better and even more of this year, as I have a chance to, I've returned to the classroom and teaching fifth and sixth grade computers at our class or at our school. But man, I think this is where I want to be investing myself professionally because I'm a big fan of David Warlick. And so back in the early days of Web 2.0, you know, I saw him talk at what was then the NEC or the NEC conference and became ISTE, read his books, used his books in some graduate courses that I taught. He has a book called Redefining Literacy for the 21st Century. I really resonate with this idea that, you know, literacy involves communication using the tools of the day. And so many of the tools of today involve video, they involve social media, they involve multimedia, not just text. And I think we've all grown up in a very linguistically biased, you know, school environment where we, you know, the five paragraph essay, the multiple choice, the text based individualized assessment, man, that's what we've done so much of. And this isn't something that we really, I don't think, can just put off on the computer teacher or that person over there. I think literacy today means being, you know, able to appropriately filter information, validate that information, determine not only what you're going to listen to and potentially believe, but also what are you going to share. And so, you know, Brian, more than anyone else that I have met, you are a font of resources when it comes to the ways in which social media has been weaponized, the ways in which different groups have utilized these tools in many cases for nefarious purposes. And the landscape is just so fractured. I mean, I like that balkanization term. So let me ask you a question about your history with the Institute and then kind of what you're teaching and things like that now. What brought you to the Institute and how do you look at these topics now, both professionally for your own interest? Because that's obviously part of this too. It's fascinating. It's an incredible world of like reading a novel of like, is this even real? But it's happening. But then there's also this professional side of what we do as students and kind of where we see us going with our careers. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So, many years ago, a fellow colleague and mine, we were young teachers and we had a commute. We would take the train back from school into the city and we got to talking and we were just fascinated with advertising propaganda. And, at that very early on, this was very, I think, to me, probably one of the most powerful documentaries I had seen was Douglas Rushkoff's Merchants of Cool. I mean, I can't believe it's almost 20, or I think it's 20 years old now. It just blew my mind about how effective and smart persuasion can be for commercial purposes. And so that just made me think, like, what I absolutely need to make sure and unpack the methods for my students, because you have to know how you're engaging with information and whether or not you're making choices of your own clear mind in order to do that. So my colleague, Ross Collin, he is a professor now at, I'm drawing a blank, University of Virginia, Commonwealth. I'll get it back in a second. But we developed a modern media class that we were able to teach in summer school. And a lot of the foundational tools of thinking critically about the political economy, the actual economy of mass media, persuasion techniques, all of that became the foundation of a class that I was able to teach for many years at West Chicago High School. And right now it's in very good hands with my colleague, Dave Jennings, who is now teaching that class. And he's doing the same work with that. I'm teaching AP language right now. So, and how I got to the University of Rhode Island Digital Literacy Conference, it was just one of those.
Oh, I think we had an internet interruption. And as is the case with some of these, I'm not sure if it is Brian or if it would happen to be me. And for the sake of recording, I guess I'm hoping it is just me, but it looks like my internet is up and I am not sure, Brian, why you have frozen up. So, Brian and I were, this is where I need to text him. So, hey, back channel, it's good to have Twitter. Our thought was to go ahead and record this conversation and share this as a podcast. One of the things that we need to end up figuring out how to do, and there he's dropped out, is how to record these internet conversations that we're having. So we're using a platform called StreamYard, and StreamYard is a platform that my friend Jason Neifer up in Missoula, Montana, and I on Wednesday nights, although we took the week off this week, typically use for our EdTech Situation Room show. And so I will expect probably Brian is going to rejoin here in just a minute. So when Google Hangouts meet, it was called Google Hangouts on Air, changed because it used to be that anybody could just use your Google account and click go, create a global broadcast that would stream online on YouTube, and then it would be recorded. Fantastic. For different reasons that I don't completely understand, Google changed that. And so you have now to use a different program in order to get that working. And so we use StreamYard. And so there he is. He's back. Hey, the conversation, telling people about StreamYard. I was saying that, you know, when that happens, you're not sure, like, is it me? You know,
It was me. Yeah. It's like a think once a day, all of a sudden, I think our Wi-Fi just decides to have a nice good belch, and here we are, we're back in.
We've learned all kinds of things about teachers' home internet.
Yeah, know, for sure. It's fast most of the time, but then every once in a while, it's like once a day. It's kind of like, you know, in mythology, there's the Charybdis there where Odysseus had to make his way across the chasm just in time before it sucked everything down. I always feel like when I'm doing something, like, will this be the time that it goes through? So, yeah, I think it was just a long winter. I had just finished. We had a contract negotiation. I was on the negotiation team, and it had been so long for me to do any real, just deep, authentic, professional development where I just had to just immerse myself, not like just these sessions where you go for a couple hours. It's just, I just wanted to be completely immersed in it. And it was probably just serendipitous. You know, I was on, I was following Renee anyway on Twitter. She advertised, you know, the media, or I'm sorry, the digital literacy conference. And it was just like, everything intersected. I'm like, I'm in, I'm doing it. I'm taking a week off, going to Rhode Island. And it's been a great experience. Obviously it's like anything. It's the connections that you make with people, all of the various different ideas that you build upon. So it's just been great.
I'm going to put a link up here. We don't have a shorter link to it yet, but, again, I'm starting to feel like media literacy. I want to ground myself in it. There was even a presentation at the conference last summer. Maybe you can help me with who it was, but we were kind of like mini kind of TED talks or Ignite talks, but her focus was like, basically plant your flag and claim your identity. Like, if you believe you're a media literacy teacher, you are, and you need to own that and you need to live that. And like, so on the, you know, little panel outside my room with my room number, my name, it says, you know, media and digital literacy teacher. That is who I am. So I went ahead and created this little Google site. It's just medialiteracy.westfriar.com. I have right now a Google Doc linked to that. And so as Brian and I have like exchanged links and podcasts, and man, you've turned me on to more podcasts, which I would probably say for anybody out there listening interested in this, like, I think that's the number one place to start is to start listening to podcasts. And maybe we can even talk about some of those that have really shaped our thinking with this. But anyway, you know, we're talking about maybe doing, if it be approved and whatever, a breakout session this summer that would focus on some of these topics. I put the words conspiracy and culture war in there because I've seen some work recently around just conspiracy theory. And one of the things I got to be careful about, we all probably do, but you know, I'm teaching fifth and sixth graders. Okay. The rabbit hole here is deep. And it's dark. And so to what you said earlier about advertising and about the ways in which cool is marketed, I mean, that is really my entry point. And that also, you know, something Renee recommended to me and others have talked about, because it's really a starting point of recognizing how media is used to influence and shape, raising awareness. And this happens really, really young with kids. I aspire perhaps to propose a class at our school. Right now I'm teaching middle school, but we have a program with Stanford. It's called MSON. It's the Malone Network of Schools. It's a pretty amazing program. We're the only K-12 school in Oklahoma that participates. And basically they're blended classes that meet via video a few times a week, and then they meet online, but they're for very advanced specialized topics that a school wouldn't be able to just offer because they wouldn't have enough enrollment. And so my thought, and you also need to have your doctorate to be able to teach for that. And I thankfully got that finished. So I'm thinking maybe about not next year, but the year after, like this year would be the year to propose it, thinking about a course that would address these issues. But I put the word culture war in here because, man, it just seems like stuff that was fringe has become much more mainstream. And especially as we're, you know, back in this political cycle of elections and things like that. So, and I think the podcast question is one that we can go to, but like, Brian, have you seen that in yourself too, with your reading and your listening about this, where stuff that seemed to be kind of more fringe and like, wow, that's just really wild out there, suddenly those kinds of issues are becoming relevant to everybody?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, you look no further than, what has, time is so weird. Was it last year or 2 years ago where, you had individuals, believing that there was some underground, child
Pizzagate.
Pizzagate, right? I mean, so like, I mean, like, how does that pass anyone's initial sniff test of actual evidence, right? And I think that's what's so important is that we have, there are a lot of layers going on here, right? Which is the more that we have become maybe tribally identified ourselves politically, that means that I think people become shopping for evidence to fit their conclusions. And unfortunately, that dynamic is pulling people away from evidentiary pieces of journalism, standard-based journalism. And that is where that shift is occurring. And so I think that is, for me, one of the most problematic practices is that people have forgotten how to, or are at least not given a civic permission to begin to ask questions about whether or not that's a good source, right? Because it might violate some type of tribal code that they can't bring that back to everyone else. That level of shame or being ostracized, you know, real or not, is enough to keep people caged from engaging in what is actually truth. And I think that's obviously so problematic.
And the whole idea of truth is literally under siege today. Right. I mean, one of the identifiable clear actors that we know has worked to manipulate perceptions and news and things like that in the United States is Russia. And we know that part of their game or part of their playbook is to really sow chaos and discord and to really get us to question everything. And some of this is like a throwback to the Cold War and psyops and things. Like, I've got a bunch of books, including my old Hardy Boys collection, which I know my wife would love for me to get rid of. But like, there's a bunch of books here, you know, about, you know, crimes of patriots, deterring democracy by Noam Chomsky. I had probably a pretty liberal set of books that I was reading for an academy graduate. But I was very interested in and remain interested in a lot of the ways that we have, we could say, promulgated our national interests abroad as the United States of America. And the playbook of psychological operations and psychological warfare and attempting to manipulate public perceptions, like these things are now playing out in dramatic ways. And, you know, Douglas Rushkoff, I have not seen that documentary you talked about. I'm familiar with him because of his book, Program or Be Programmed, which I read a number of years ago. And I followed him a little bit with his podcast and where he's gone. But like, the ways in which algorithms and technology is being used as a huge, it's not just a lever, it's a hammer to push agendas, to make hashtags trend, to cause, hopefully in the minds of some mainstream media journalists, because they're a big target, right, to pick up on some of these things. And that's where like that Pizzagate, which was, you know, the core of that is that Hillary Clinton was involved in a child pornography pedophilia ring in a pizza parlor in New York City. Crazy. Like that came out of 4chan. And as a specific example, like how many adults today know about that and also put the pieces together? So this is one of the reasons why, I mean, and let's talk a little bit about podcasts. You've helped me, I think, get this view of a larger world and connect dots. And so one of the reasons I'm excited about engaging in this conversation today and the possibilities of summer work and things that could go further is because I need to be able to connect more dots. And that's why the word culture war is in there, because there are these culture wars and technology is being used as a lever to try to, you know, get our attention, in some cases, get us to question the very idea of truth and the idea that journalism can be valid. You know, some really big things. So is culture, how do you see culture war fitting into this or that term? Is that something you're, what are the
terms? And I don't, you know, and it could be, I mean, even within that, there's a spectrum, right? So, you know, on the one end, you may have, you know, both sides are going to have their boogeymen, right? So you have, the threat of Antifa that's been imagined, and then you have like what now is Big Igloo, you know, the guys that are running around with the guns and all of this, right? And those certainly create a lot of fear for discourse. Like, how is anyone going to come to the table with that going on? Not to mention any other kind of group that has that. But I think the part that is more sinister in all this is the kind of quitting, right? Like, it all sucks. Why bother, right? And I think that is really the real outcome for so much of this, is that it creates such deep cynicism that people quit. And it's not worth it. They throw their hands up. They don't want to participate. They think everyone's a crook, and there is really no way to go about that. So I think that's, in many ways, probably the greatest outcome for the propagandist, is to kind of sow that type of, I guess, just contempt of the system and just
nihilism.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's precisely an end for that, where in many ways it just kind of suppresses votes or any type of enthusiasm to engage in the process of what we have in a democracy. That's a win for the sides that would want to make us weaker, for sure, is to completely drain out our civic curiosities and needs as a citizen.
Yeah. Well, let me also just say hello to everyone who is viewing us live. We actually have 6 live viewers right now. If you want to put in a comment, I should be able to see that. I know I can from YouTube. Normally, I stream to a Facebook page instead of my profile. We haven't set up anything on Facebook about this. But if you want to chime in with a question for us, we would welcome that. I'm gonna try and share my screen here in a second, and I'm gonna go to this Google document, which you're welcome to link to. It is linked right now, just from this website, medialiteracy.westfriar.com, and I'm going to click on my share screen and see how this is gonna work. And what I'm gonna attempt to do. Oh, look at that! Isn't that amazing? This is the document that we've got, and basically, you know, if you were to look at the direct message conversation between Brian and I since last July, you know, we probably even scratched the surface of resources that have been shared there. A lot of those are podcasts, but we have in here a little bit about kind of an overview, but then some vocabulary terms. Only a couple podcasts, man. There's a whole bunch that we can fill in here, but some episodes, some different documentaries, some articles, some books. And so, you know, basically this is a place at this point where we're kind of building some resources. Where do you want this to go, Brian, in terms of just personally, in terms of a project? Are you thinking about like a 45-minute breakout for the summer conference? And cause like I said, we've all got different, we have both, this is interesting personally, and then professionally we have interest in this. So just specifically, cause this is the first time we've actually had a conversation synchronously about this. Everything's since the summer has been basically over Twitter. So
yeah.
What is your desire?
I think, you know, we always think about who your audience is, who would be tuning into this. And if they are showing up, they're curious. They may not need as much background in terms of knowing everything that's going on. They may have some of that. But I think I would imagine that in some ways they want to be able to take, like anytime you go to a conference, they want to take something that's actionable to bring back to their classrooms, their curriculum, and make it work. Obviously, this is pretty touchy because you might run into I don't think with the people that would be in a session like this, but you know, they do have to bring it back to their students who have family members that may not see this as reality, that they'll see that this is we're part of the conspiracy, we're part of an agenda and all that, as opposed to being, again, trying to bring transparency to the various different methods that are attempting to divide us with these again, bad faith type of persuasion techniques. So I think that would be something that I think it's kind of like the expression. I always like try to think when you broach controversial topics with students or something like that, it's the classic metaphor of boiling a frog, right? Like you just don't go right in there, put it in their face, because then they shut down, right? So it's kind of like you start off with very agreeable questions and inquiry until finally then you can then have various logical discussions about, does this make sense? Can we look at the evidence and make reasonable claims based off that? And do those reasonable claims align with what what your values are? And I think that's what I always kind of think about, Venn diagrams, right? So like, you know, there's like, what are the intersecting things that most people have? I don't think that we're still that far off, you know? So as much as we say culture wars and all that stuff, what's intersecting in a lot of that, if you approach it correctly and you don't come in, you know, with your fists blazing, if you come in with a kind of a series of, you know, again, Socratic questions that align with shared values, I think it's easier to kind of bring people over rather than come in with guns blazing and say, that's trash, your thinking is off, you know, your sources are terrible. You can't get there. It's kind of like, you know, you have to plant various different seeds of persuasion slowly, because not everyone is, I'm an English teacher, so I'm very, I get lost in my own metaphors sometimes, but you know, many people, you have to figure out how to get over the castle walls, and you know, how do you bridge that moat with a series of questions that basically bring out immutable truths of where our shared values are first. And I think that's important.
Man, I love that. You know, one of the activities sessions that I enjoyed the most at the Summer Institute was the one that focused on that article from the New York Times that was about the avalanche that happened in the Pacific Northwest. And we were divided around tables, but we had activities that, you know, we dove into. And so we were analyzing that, and then we kind of reported back. But that activity was a great way. I mean, some of the takeaways for that is, wow, look at the possibilities of multimedia publication. You know, the ways in which if you have a budget and you really want to just push it to what can we do? You know, there was audio, there was animations, there was video, there were timelines, there were all of these different things.
Do you think that this was this is the suite of tools that were from the Knight Foundation Journalism Lab, I believe. Does that sound familiar?
Troy Hicks was the leader of this.
I think
session.
That was the session. Yeah.
It might have been. It was fantastic. Maybe we can emerge with something like that, which is going to be hands-on. This document, mm-hmm. I kind of see it as sort of like, whatever, for your dissertation, you've got your literature review. I mean, I kind of see this as a literature review to say, if you'd like to, here are, you know, really good, you know, resources to jump into, books, podcasts, articles. I mean, and I also like the idea of individual episodes, but that is sort of a baseline of saying, if you, you know, here's recommended reading, watching, and listening. But in terms of taking it to the classroom, because man, I teach a trimester course, and it's both good and bad in that I get to iterate three times. And that's great. But the bummer is I literally have about 22 50-minute sessions with my kids. Boom, that's it. And during the normal school year, that's every other day. It's just not that many meetings. So, I walked out of the Summer Institute last year rather naively thinking I was going to tackle climate change with my students. And what I ended up, you know, co-creating is a lesson probably was good for graduate students. It wasn't going to work for fifth and sixth grade. But, you know, the issue of conspiracy ties in terms of climate science and climate change. I think I'm going to probably do a unit with my students this next year, with my sixth graders, just about the moon landings. You know, kids today, I think, and I'm using our 16-year-old daughter as an example, I think they've had more exposure to conspiracy theories surrounding the moon landings than any previous generation. And obviously that we landed in 69, so there hasn't been that many generations. But still, like compared to what I heard and saw, like helping, and I think in some cases to the point about political sensitivity and shared values and things like that, it might not be that we want to do a full on, let's jump right into the politics of the election and whether people are, what people are saying about protests. I mean, being that current, but I'm thinking about looking at the moon landing. There's a fantastic video, and I've got this saved in a playlist, where a guy breaks down why we didn't have the technology to fake the moon landing. You know, I mean, there was the live streaming, just like this, the fact that, hey, we can just get on our phones or our computers, open up a channel, live broadcast to the world. You know, anyway, the technology just wasn't there at that time. So I like that idea that you said about Socratic questions and shared values. I like the idea of thinking about activities that we could specifically do, because we're talking about issues that are extremely complex, and there's all these different parts. And in like one 45-minute workshop or whatever, we're not going to connect all the dots for people. But if we can be, I love the word catalyst, because a catalyst, I'm not a chemist, I just stay at Holiday and Express this every once in a while. A catalyst is this thing that when you put it into this reaction, it causes a reaction. You know, without the catalyst, you don't have this chemical reaction. And so I kind of look at this workshop as I would like for us to be a catalyst for people thinking about asking questions, thinking about things, and then wanting more resources and wanting to pursue more. And then also having a pathway, like with this, you know, list of resources to be able to jump into. Because that's part of my journey, you know, coming out of the Institute, was being energized. And then thanks to you, primarily, like having this pathway of, wow, have you seen this podcast? You know, take a look at this. Like it's just been this journey of continued exploration and learning. And I think that's what I'd love a workshop to do, in a way that doesn't, like you said, scare people, get their fists up, get them defensive. Cause that's one of the things I think we all are concerned and very reasonably concerned about, bringing this back to students and parents.
I think that's a great idea to maybe use the moon landing as the case study to then use as that kind of operational, Socratic way to unpack, well, why would someone, let's look at how this source is faulty. These are the type of questions that we would ask to really kind of pull it apart. You know, it's interesting that you said, you know, I'm just kind of bringing this back to something that you had said earlier, in this discussion. Is we have so many tools to share with our students that are not text, right? You know, we can make videos and all this stuff. It's ironic because that's also the double-edged sword, because on the other side of that, it means that people can create content so quickly that is so shoddy and unsupported and, but has the veneer of authenticity and expertise, that now we're having conversations about whether or not the moon landing happened, if the earth is flat, all of these other things, because the shell of the, you know, the medium of it already carries a sense of gravitas of being, worthy of accepting it as fact, even though it's not. So this is why we saw so much hay, being created when the plandemic video came out about a month ago, where it's like, look, video, look at everyone. Everyone was so excited to think that they brought back and they had uncovered this incredible conspiracy. When it comes down to it, even with the most cursory of investigation, the pillar person involved in that documentary, completely imploded the case, and the ethos of her made it nearly impossible, but it doesn't matter because it had already been viewed how many millions of times, shared how many times, and it kind of goes back to, was that a Mark Twain quote? You know, by the time a lie spreads halfway around the world, that's when truth is already putting its pants on. Sorry, or putting its shoes on. Sorry, the alarm went off.
We'll get that Twain quote. We'll add it to the document.
Yeah, for sure.
I got a quick story about the pandemic, because so that happened a month ago, maybe three or four weeks ago. It was like the week before we went to get our son, and he was supposed to graduate from, well, he did. He actually graduated from college. In fact, he's in Houston, yeah. And he went to NASA.
Congrats.
He picked up his computer. So he's working for a contractor. And anyway, I can date it that way, because here's the thing. This becomes personal, and maybe in the activity and the lesson, we can do this too, because we all face choices not only about what we're going to share, but are we going to confront? Are we going to correct? Are we going to engage with, have dialogue with folks that we maybe connected to on Facebook? That's primarily where that's happened for me, you know, and I'm not sure. We've got a few live viewers here. Hello to whoever is out there. Unless, you know, people make a comment or something like that. I don't know who they are. There's a variety of folks from our church family back in Lubbock, Texas, where my wife and I moved up here to Oklahoma in 2006. We've got folks in our church family here. We've got, you know, school friends, but we've also got other people that are, you know, professional connections. It's just it's a huge diverse group, which is wonderful. But it also becomes challenging in this heavily politicized time that we live in. I haven't read Ezra Klein's book, but his book about why we're polarized, I think, is on our list. Mm-hmm. I think that we as citizens need to have a better understanding about the politicized culture that we live in, the polarized culture that we live in. It is politicized too. And then think about how we're going to engage or not engage with each other. Because, you know, I unfortunately lost a friendship as a result of an interaction that I had with about the pandemic video. And maybe, so there's all kinds of choices, right? I didn't have to say anything. I could have said something different. I could have tried to say it privately in person, you know, instead of using an electronic medium, which always, by the way, is harder than whenever something is controversial or emotional. So I don't know. What do you think about that idea of how you kind of help equip people with skills to think about how they engage with friends and family on these things?
Yeah. And I think this might be a source that we put on our list. Great science podcast on NPR is called Shortwave. And within the past couple of weeks, they did an episode basically, how do you talk to family members who are sharing clear disinformation, misinformation? And there's been some other literature that's been written recently about, you know, how can we somehow engage this without really kind of burning the village of our relationship with that? So that'll be one to put on the list. And a lot of really good suggestions about that. And I think you're right. You know, I was kind of texting back and forth with some friends, and they're struggling too when people will post things that are either odious in terms of how they are either dehumanizing someone or that is completely out of whack with what is consistently accepted as scientific fact. And you know what you can say. You know, we're trying to develop different types of frames of rhetoric to say something like, you know, as an American, I am concerned. If this is true, and before I act on this, can you do one more step and find where you find that to be true in a standard-based journalism? So before I can investigate this further. So in that way, you're not calling them out, but you are saying, I'm not smacking down what you're saying. I'm just asking you to go one step further and prove it to me that this is something that's validated by facts. And then if they're not interested in it, then maybe you're planting doubt in their mind that maybe that source isn't legit. And so I think it's just it's not that you're not admonishing them publicly. And that's part of it's one of the best books I think I've read recently, and it's just a wide span of how social media has become weaponized, is P.W. Singer, and I'm drawing a blank who his co-author was. It's on our list. It's called Like War. And one of the stats that they had put on this is just how much more time you engage with Facebook if it's a political post versus it's a commercial post. I mean, it's like double. That's good for them, right? You're on there. Like, and Tim Wu, he's a great, he wrote a book called The Attention Merchants. And it's this idea of harvesting eyeballs, right? Like we have this resource that we have to maintain, cultivate and grow. And if we see that politics is keeping people rooted in our platform that much longer, that's a net win for Twitter, Facebook, and anything else. And so they're going to be very reluctant to find modes from their programming to probably end that. So then it becomes maybe incumbent on us as the users to put it back on the people that would do something like that and say, I'm not dismissing what you're saying, but I'm asking you to double check your source because I think you're a smart person. I think you went to high school. I think you went, these are the basic things that you were taught there. Why can't you go one step further and validate that? Because again, to go back to this thing that we were saying before, you might, hopefully it would be the idea that you're shopping for information to fit your conclusion.
Yeah.
And that's just not how any of this is going to get better. It's just a series of easily knocked down straw men that we can continue to see how people make their arguments when they just find faulty sources that are just simply not credible. But you brought it into my life. Now you have to prove it. If you can say it as nicely as possible, I think that is a way to kind of put the onus back on them.
I think those ideas are great, and resources again to point people to, but because it's multi-level, but there's the level of classroom. How do we talk about this with students? How do we engage with this on a literacy level? This is about critical thinking too, right? This is about how do we decide what to believe? You mentioned balkanization. I like that term a lot. A fractured media environment. We have a more balkanized, fractured media environment than any previous generation in Earth history. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. We do. And so the skill set that we bring, like we've all got to up our game when it comes to how we operate, because it's not just these three channels of mainstream media headline with Walter Cronkite as an option. You know, I mean, we're so far away from that. Another thought, I want to shout out to Jess Birchfield, who has made a comment there from Facebook, one of our friends from Lubbock, who she's a fourth grade teacher now. I think that considering developmentally, like I'm saying, I'm teaching fifth and sixth grade. So like tackling the moon landing and thinking about why is it that there are so many people questioning that today? How do we break that down? How do we decide what it is that we believe? And then also, how do we recognize the potentially radicalizing influence of YouTube? Because I think you, and maybe some other folks too, but I'm pretty sure you recommended this podcast, Rabbit Hole. It's a New York Times podcast. This is the best podcast that I have encountered that really traces a story of someone who, in this case, was radicalized to white supremacy, but then crossed back over. And it is super eye-opening. They've got interviews with one of the guys for Google and YouTube who designed the algorithm, who created the code that would make people, that would encourage people. And I would say make, but like, it's really powerful in terms of the levers that we're talking about. And you said, you know, politics has so much more engagement. I'm going to try to share my screen real quick and do a shout out here to a great framework that I think is on our list and we want to let people know about. This is from Mike Caulfield, and this is called the SIFT, the four moves. Mike is part of the Digital Polarization Initiative. And so the first step of SIFT, stop, investigate the source, find better coverage, and then trace claims, quotes, and media to the original context. The first one is stop. And so that is something that, you know, I've heard people talk about, this is such a wonderful website. It's frictionless in the way that we can share. But see, that's the danger, right? When it's so easy to just pass it on and share it. So anyway, I like the idea of sort of a cognitive professional. Here's how I can, you know, activity I can use with my students, lesson. But then I really think we need to attend to the personal too. My friend Kevin Honeycutt, years ago was talking about social media, and it's like a digital playground where kids are on the playground, but there's no adults, you know, monitoring recess. They're not present. Well, I mean, how do any people of any age, how do we acquire better skills with, you know, engaging with each other over these platforms? These are disintermediated platforms, or I guess they're mediated platforms. Facebook is mediating the conversation in between us with email. I mean, I hope I am far less likely today to write a long email when I'm upset, you know, than I was earlier in my career. I will not, you know, embarrass myself by telling those stories, but probably a lot of us could tell stories about emails we wish we'd never sent. And a lot of times it does have to do with emotion. And I think that is the number one thing that we want everybody to know with this is when you get something gets an emotional rise out of you, man, it's time to raise the stop sign. And put on the brakes. In fact, I'm even thinking visual aids, like in the workshop, maybe we need a stop sign, you know, because visually that is what we need to try and do is to say, wait a second, is somebody yanking my chain here? Is somebody really trying to provoke me? Because, and I think you've shared some of these with me. Some of the ads that came out of the 2016 campaign were so egregious and like, you only saw those if you were in the targeted group that was, you know, selected for those kinds of advertisements. But they're absolutely designed to push buttons, pull levers, try and get us to emotionally respond. And I don't know, is that something that is that something that's in your curriculum or it's been in your curriculum as far as that kind of media literacy and being aware of the emotional side?
So one of the things that we've been really lucky. Our school, we've had some former colleagues, Mary Ellen Daniels and Sean Healy, who have gone on to work for the McCormick Foundation. And as a result, they have this relationship with the News Literacy Project. And I can't recommend enough for anyone to either, and I think I can, I'll put in where I can find some of their YouTube videos. I know through the University of Rhode Island, they did something through the Metcalf Institute about how to find, how to combat COVID misinformation, disinformation. But Peter Adams and John Silva are incredible educators, and they will, their sessions, if you can attend them, if you'll go to a national conference, or obviously they've been moving a lot of their work remotely. I've seen like, I can't even count how many I go to. Usually whenever they have it, I see it, but they do precisely that. They'll show you what are the ways in which people are tricked. And so one of those things is exactly what you said, Wes, which is, how can we find something that is just so politically incendiary that you are going to absolutely get hooked in and uncritically analyze it and send it off to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, people immediately.
Yeah.
But before you do that, did you even bother to look at the details? Did you notice that that particular sign that was being held was a big white poster board, which is arguably one of the easiest things that could be photoshopped? And what's so great about the News Literacy Project and the tools that they give is they said, these are all of the various different websites where you can do reverse image searches. This is how you can then go back and see, did they actually tweet that? And it's been for me, and this is why I think I'm so personally engaged with this. You kind of feel like you're an investigator. Like you see something like
you are, you're
no, that doesn't smell right. And I can tell you, like, at least once a day, I'll see something on Twitter and I'm like, no, I'm not so sure about that. And you can see if it was vetted or not, or there are all these various different tools, vetted is the wrong word, whether or not it was authentic or not. And you can see very quickly to the extent that it was manipulated. That's for us. We know that set, that heuristic, that type of timeline or that type of toolbox to engage and unpack these things. If you're just there to, just, you know, again, and the other part too is being mindful of the type of, social fabric by which we are engaged in. I think this is one of my favorite, quotes. I've just been dwelling on this. E.O. Wilson. He's a biologist, and he said, the problem with humanity is that we have Paleolithic brains, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. And I think when he first wrote this, the godlike technology, I think, was maybe in context to nuclear weaponry. But instead, I think now that godlike technology is this kind of omniscience of social media by which it knows everyone's thoughts. It knows what we search and all of that. So to kind of go back to why that's important, that Paleolithic part of that is that we're social animals, and we are validated by the social currency that we bring back to our tribe. And if we can get that little dopamine kick of a like or whatever it is, because we brought something that made someone laugh, or we stirred it up, or they respond in such a way because we are so separate from each other, that's a win. And so, the more that we understand how our brain works and how we operate in this whole fabric of our collective social environment, that at least gives us the capacity to pause before we do that. And we, again, pollute the well with misinformation, is to know that people might be gaming you. And it's like, think about like how would you advise your son, Wes, before he goes to buy his first car, right? You'd be like, okay, they're going to try to upsell you with this. They're going to try to, like, you would do the same thing, and no one would fault you for trying to give him the tools to know, look, this is what you want, and be very clear with that. There should be no separation of that when we are engaging in social media, especially as we are trying to navigate what is truth. We should have that permission to ask those questions and not feel, but also understand why that was falling in our lap and how someone was trying to make us use the exigence of sharing that with someone else. And I think that's a really important thing that people have to have, that metacognition of what to do with it once it's in your lap, and and your choice of what you're going to do with that once it happens.
Absolutely. Well, we've been going about 50 minutes, and I think we'll go about 10 more due to my own tardiness. We started a little bit after the top of the hour. For those of you that may have joined a little late, I want to let everyone know this link, which will also be shared below in Facebook and on YouTube, right now has a link to a Google document that Brian and I have been working on. But this is medialiteracy.westfriar.com. Man, several thoughts. And then I'm going to ask you about what podcasts are you into the most, and which ones are you going to recommend people jump into? Because, like, you are the source for podcasts on this. But one thought is that I'm very interested in the truth side of this. And I don't know if this is the epistemological side, but like, I was in the Air Force for a while, and I got out, and I had to decide what to do. Because I didn't get to stay in as long as I thought I would. And I decided to become a teacher. And so I had the opportunity to go through the teacher education program, the postdoc program at Texas Tech University in Lubbock. And there's a lot of wonderful memories that I have of that, a lot of things that I learned. But man, one of my times of cognitive dissonance was actually in my children's literature class when we were reading Jane Yolen's book, Encounter. And this is a revisionist portrayal of the encounter of cultures between Christopher Columbus and Europeans and First Nations or Native Americans or Indians. Here in Oklahoma, we have 36 recognized tribes, and a lot of our tribes actually do want to be called Indians. I didn't know that until I moved here. But nonetheless, like, you can read some of that literature, and you can also read criticisms of Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers and all these sort of things. And I don't know if spiral you into nihilism is an exaggeration, but you can really start to question, well, wait a minute, all these things, these heroes, these people I thought were wonderful, man, look, they're really not. There's these, you know, Thomas Jefferson had children with one of his slaves, and, you know, all these things, you know, sort of like the fairy tale or the naivete. And I think it is so important, and I don't know exactly where I'm going with us other than just expressing this is a thought I have around this. I want students, I want adults, I want citizens to be inspired by truth, by value, by the idea of representative government, by self-determination, the values that are embodied in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for the United Nations. Like, there are important values and truths which we need to defend, and we need to struggle for, and we need to advocate for in the classroom. I'll start the podcast conversation by saying, wind of change, Wind of Change. Those of us that grew up in the 80s, that saw the Berlin Wall fall. You know, my wife was teaching in Germany. A quick little side note, my dad traveled to Berlin in 1962 before the Berlin Wall went up by the Brandenburg Gate. He has pictures and slides that show before the wall. My wife was teaching in Germany in the 90s. She was there when the wall fell. We have a piece of the wall in our living room. I could grab it. She was there when that happened. Our son was an exchange student, and actually we hosted a student from what was East Berlin. And then Alex went and lived in East Berlin with the wall being down. Wind of Change was like the ballad of the end of the Cold War. And this podcast is talking about the idea that the rock band that wrote it, the Scorpions, actually that it was written with help from the CIA. And it was part of a very effective campaign of infusing hope and dreams and vision of a better tomorrow, you know, in so many different people's lives. And so anyway, I'm really interested in the, if I'm saying this right, the epistemological side of this, the idea that there is truth and the idea that there are values that we should hold dear, and that what we don't want is to all become nihilists. And there, that is a risk of all this disinformation, information pollution, et cetera. So let me toss it to you, sir. Any thoughts on that? And then where should people start with some podcast listening if they're going to the font of Brian Turnbaugh to get your recommendations
today? Yeah, and I think you bring up, you know, that is kind of like one of the, I think if I remember vaguely, you know, some of the criticisms of diving too deeply into postmodern thought, right? Which is the idea that, like, well, everything should be questioned and we keep on tearing things down. That might, one of the outcomes is, again, to use that metaphor, a rabbit hole of not thinking that anything matters, that there aren't objective truths that we can hold fast to values that matter, right? I mean, there should be certain things that we can say, like, no, is this something that maximizes human worth and happiness, and is that something that we should work towards, right? And so I think that's important. I think, you know, for me, one of the readings that I'm going to try to go after this summer, I want to read more about the theories of John Rawls and the veil of ignorance and theories of justice and all that. And the idea of the veil of ignorance is, I think, one of the most interesting thought experiments that you can go through from a kind of a political standpoint, which is, if I were to summarize something like this, which is, if you truly do believe that we live in a society that is fair and equitable, then you would be willing to take this bet that tomorrow morning you could wake up and you could be not you, but you could be anyone else. Now, do you feel so strongly walking down the street if you are now this person from ethnicity Y and gender X or whatever that may be? Are you still sure that society is designed in a way that's going to make your life unencumbered by unnecessary constraints? So I think that's one way of kind of thinking about going back to the E.O. Wilson quote, is then if we are aware enough, then we can maybe help design systems that can somehow make sure that we are better than our, we can appeal to our better angels, so to speak. And I think that's where my head is at lately, with so much kind of going on in sync. So what's going to emerge from this moment? Podcasts, I would say Your Undivided Attention is fantastic. That is one that, for me, I think they're not every week. Sometimes they might be biweekly, or maybe some, I think they had one where they didn't have one for a month, but I think that is consistently one that is exceptional in terms of sharing what is the landscape and the ethical challenges. But really what I like about Your Undivided Attention, and I'm drawing a blank who are the, it will be in the show notes for sure. But they do a great job with some really great suggestions of how to make things better at the end of every podcast. And I think that one's exceptional. The one I think for me, that was like, okay, we've lost cabin pressure in terms of like something is going on here. And this might be one that might be easier to kind of share with people who are unaware of what are the type of campaigns that go underneath the surface. You know, there's the iceberg effect, right? What's really kind of going underneath. It was a reply all episode called The Prophet. That one just blew my mind. I don't want to play spoiler to it, but it was basically following the story of a journalist who had been accosted, and she was trying to find some type of justice from someone who she felt that she had been harassed publicly in the streets for some type of like jackass like MTV TV show or web series on YouTube in Mexico. And then all of a sudden she realized that she was a bit player in a larger game of political propaganda. And that was mind blowing. So I would start off with those two, and there are many. And I think as the list grows, there'll just be so many episodes. I mean, I think we probably have a football field's worth of DMs on Twitter of podcasts that we've listened to.
We do. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things why I'm excited to have started to build a Google Doc, whether this project remains conspiracies and culture wars or is something maybe less, I don't know what the right word for that is, in your face, you know, talking about the moon landing and media literacy, or, you know, something about web literacy and being able to vet information. It's interesting because, you know, that podcast I mentioned, A Rabbit Hole, I mean, radicalization mm-hmm. does happen. How are we influenced? You know, a lot of times it's through relationship, and it's through ongoing engagement and ongoing opportunity to be able to listen to a voice, to be able to hear something. And, you know, that podcast you mentioned, The Prophet from Reply All, I vividly remember you shared that during the conference. And so I listened to that, and man, it does open your eyes to a wider world, but as with everything, we've got to be asking questions. We need to be asking questions about the sources. And so I guess, you know, one of my concluding thoughts, and we're over an hour here, so we'll wrap this up. Two of our three kids are on Tinder now, and they're also on lots of other apps, right? We've got a daughter, our youngest is 16, and then we've got one that'll be turning 19 this summer. And then, you know, our son, I guess, is 22. And it's very interesting with COVID and sheltering at home. You know, after college, I mean, he's come and lived with us for a while, and they may not start down there in his office until August. So they're down there house hunting. But anyway, you know, I didn't think we'd have our kids back. And it's really interesting to have college and post-college kids around for a lot of reasons, but one of them is to see the intersection that they have with their devices and then socially. And of course, it's very challenging to just navigate as a married person, you know, what am I doing with masks and social distancing and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, I have really been thinking about how important it is. And one of the things that we're doing with our kids in our house and with the students that we teach, I mean, we are trying to equip them to make good choices in a very complex and messy world that is filled with, yes, screens and technologies, but with different voices and different perspectives. And so that could be seen as a bottom line, is how are we equipping kids to go out into the world with whatever the next device is, the apps and all that, and be equipped to make good choices and to have resources to go to and hopefully not to fall in a hole and to fall in a trap.
I think that's the most difficult question is, you know, and I think this is something that I think we've all struggled with, is the idea of how do you equip people with the proper tools for skepticism so it doesn't turn into cynicism. So I think this was in one of the, a podcast I listened to last week. It was with Decode with Kara Swisher, and she had two internet researchers. Sorry, it's just not on the top of my head right now. One from Columbia University and one from Oxford. And they were talking about how it's funny that you bring up Tinder, is that Tinder was being used by bots to basically influence people for one of the United Kingdom's prime minister votes, right? They created these bots and they said, hey, I kind of like you and you're kind of cute and blah, blah, blah. And, but they were adjacent.
Don't you think you all vote
so,
together?
I mean, so now think about just one more thing. You don't even know who you're talking to on a dating app. May not even be real. It's just a series of zeros and ones that you think is there. And then they ghost you, you know, right? Then you're gone. And then they're never to be seen again. But, and the only reason why they found out about it is I think that one of their, I think it was, I can't remember who the candidate was, but they said, yeah, that was, we did this. And it was, we had several people, engage with this. So, so reality is a struggle. The more that we kind of, you know, shift from what's right in front of us into the series of zeros and ones, yeah, it is, it's a challenge.
We've got to up our game. So, all right, well, Brian, when you're not here, you know, live streaming with me on StreamYard, as we're doing for the first time here, where can people find you online?
Yeah. You know, WeGoTwits is my Twitter handle. And, I don't retweet much. Mostly stuff is just kind of encouraging things, for my students and, something silly. But if I do put anything serious, it is usually in the realm of, media literacy and disinformation and fighting disinformation and things like that. So.
Okay. Well, I'm on Twitter as well, W. Fryer. I'm tweeting a lot of stuff about a lot. It's not just media literacy, but this website, medialiteracy.westfryer.com, I did go ahead and put a link to just the media literacy posts that I've made since probably, I don't know, for a while, for a few years. I use the hashtag media lit often to be sharing those kinds of things. On that website as well, I've got a link to the Summer Institute for Digital Literacy is what it's called. It's media literacy too, and that's a conversation that we have about what is that. But I'm very excited. I'm registered to go, and it's possible that we may be able to share something. So I propose we can continue building this document, and then maybe we can also think about maybe below it or whatever, so we don't have to create another doc right now, some ideas for what a workshop might look like. Because I think, and I've taken some notes that I'll transfer down, but that idea of Socratic questions, shared values, case study, like I said, that Troy Hicks session where we dove into some tools and we got to like dig in together with others, you know, it helped us peel back some of the layers of the onion. And so maybe how does that sound as an idea for?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to dive into it for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, very good. Well, thanks to everybody who has tuned in. Jess, thanks for letting us know you're out there in Facebook world. And if anybody does want to reach out to us, you can contact us on Twitter and these conversations will continue.
Cool. See ya.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcasts are independently produced by Wesley Fryer and are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Only license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.